It's a Friday on Scoops with Danny Mac, and we have the chance to visit with Ben Fredrickson of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, as we always do, from stltoday.com. And we have college football this weekend. Mizzou is back in action against South Carolina. The Beyond the Road, Will Muschamp, was fired this past week. And, well, Ben, they've got a new head coach, the Gamecocks do. Will that change anything for them? And Mizzou back in action. What do you think as you size up this weekend? And as always, good morning to you. How are things going?
Good morning, Dan. Yeah, I'm doing well. And I think the Missouri football team is feeling good because they're going to get to play a game, fingers crossed, still, as always, until kickoff, right, against South Carolina, their first game in about 3 weeks. A Mizzou team that has been waiting to play a game for, it's crazy to think about it, you know, on the other side of a month. You know, one more week without a game and they'd be at a month without one played. It's almost like an off season. You know, the good news for the Tigers is they've been able to practice. This hasn't been a COVID situation where their team was shut down. It was just really isolated at one position group. So they were still able to practice around it, but they're tired of practicing each other. They want to play. So they gotta remember how to play a game. But you gotta think they're ready to do that. South Carolina's in an interesting spot because, you know, they've really changed since Mizzou last played. They've got an interim coach. They've had multiple players now opt out and say they're going to start preparing for the NFL draft without the team as Will Muschamp heads off into the sunset with a $14 million buyout. So you got to wonder, you know, what motivation does South Carolina going to have? We've seen teams that fire out of the gates and play hard for the interim. We've seen teams that kind of predictably roll over after their head coach is fired. We'll see what the Gamecocks bring, but this should be a winnable game for Missouri. They didn't play well their last time out against Florida, but we've since found out that Florida is a legitimate national championship contender. So I think Mizzou will be motivated and excited to play. And I do wonder if South Carolina will feel the same way after what it's been through in the other Columbia this year.
Boy, isn't it unbelievable when you look at Will Muschamp getting fired, walking away with $14 million, and here we are in a COVID situation, and a guy gets fired, he gets a guarantee of $14 million, and these universities and these colleges are wondering about trying to figure out how to make payments to keep certain parts of their programs alive, the secondary sports, the Olympic sports. How are certain teams able to get to places on chartered flights? Those kind of things. And yet Will Muschamp walks away with $14 million. And they wonder, well, how are we in this predicament? Well, maybe this is why. This is how it happens, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. And here's the thing, the craziest part of all of this, Ray Tanner, the South Carolina athletic director, is the guy who hired Will Muschamp. And now he's going to be the guy who gets to go out and hire the new football coach.
Wow!
and he's not the one who's packing his boxes along with Will Muschamp. That's hard to believe with all we've heard about in the, you know, the financial pinch of the pandemic. It wasn't that long ago that Ray Tanner was telling the leaders of the university that the athletics department was going to come in, you know, somewhere around 45% short of their projected revenue because of the pandemic, and that projection did not include paying Will Muschamp more than $10 million to go away. That's just the beginning, Dan. You got to pay the new coach. Usually when you hire a coach, he gets paid more than the last guy. Not always, but usually. And you got to hire probably all new staff because very few times is there realistic replacements held on between staff. Sometimes, not always, there's always some turnover, but the likelihood that the new guy is going to want to bring in all his own coaches is pretty high. So that's all those buyouts too. So you're talking about a significant investment there. It makes you wonder if South Carolina already has its guy. It makes me wonder if South Carolina has watched other schools in the league make, I wouldn't say controversial hires, but ones that threw some ripples toward the commissioner and Lane Kiffin and even Mike Leach with some of the background that he's had at different stops. It makes me wonder if South Carolina says, okay, other schools are maybe overlooking a few things. We're going to overlook a few things and go get Hugh Freeze, who has been outstanding at Liberty during his kind of rehab tour there. Now, South Carolina would, I think, have to be interested in that because of the offense that he could bring. They're just getting rid of a defensive head coach. Their fan base has an expectation for exciting offense because it had Steve Spurrier at one time. It makes me wonder if Hugh Freeze might be back in the SEC sooner rather than later, and that's right now just with one open job. There could be more coming.
I also want to lead this into watching Greg Marshall leave Wichita State. And for anybody that was involved with the Missouri Valley Conference, which I was at the time, and Greg was the head coach at Wichita State, did great things in wins and losses, got to a Final Four, made a lot of money for the conference, and he himself made a lot of money. But we watched him act like a child on the sidelines. His wife acted like a child, and it came at a cost of $7 million for the university to make him go away. And yet it came at verbal abuse for kids. It came at apparent physical abuse for the kids. And yet because of that, they have to make him go away. And they're going to pay him $7 million, or $7.5 million, I think, to go away. Why are universities paying him, and apparently with abuse, to pay him to go away? I don't understand that either. Here's a guy that's abusing kids, apparently, and he resigns, and yet they're going to pay him $7.5 million. I don't understand that either. What do you think about that?
Well, it makes me wonder what the school knew about and tried to cover up, or what kind of skeletons Greg Marshall has on his administration. Usually, in a situation like this, you would see a guy fired for cause, and he doesn't get that money. He doesn't get a severance. He doesn't get his buyout because he did something wrong. That would be what you would expect to see in a situation like this. That's what you see when a coach is caught breaking rules or breaking the law or not operating under the code of his contract. And usually schools that take that stance when a coach has done something screwed up, very rarely do they get tagged for payback via lawsuits, because it means all those details come out. What's interesting here is that Wichita State has went above and beyond to keep the details of its investigation private. And that makes me wonder, not that they're worried about protecting the good image of Greg Marshall, which is now kaput, but worried about covering their own ass. Pardon my French, because there's something there that they don't want to get out. There's something there that is convincing them to give Greg Marshall $7 million so he doesn't turn around and sue them or spill his side of the story. Look, there have been a lot of players who have come forward and talked about the way he mistreated them. I'll credit Jeff Goodman, who's been on this story for a long time. You got to credit Dana O'Neill at The Athletic, who was working on the story as well. You know, everything from just being a bad coach in terms of, using really poor and outdated and caveman type, motivational tactics, to physically, striking a player, and everything in between. There are multiple stories about it now out there. There are players who are, this isn't anonymous source stuff, players are putting their names on it, which is really rare for a story like this. And if it wasn't for these players, then I think Wichita State would still happily be paying Greg Marshall a lot of money to coach their team, doing his best Bob Knight impression from the Stone Age. I feel like, to some degree, I think we're all probably part of the problem. I've sat there at Arch Madness and gone, God, I should write a column just about this guy's sideline demeanor and how pathetic it is. Just spend a whole column talking about, why do we allow this? Why is this not shut down? I mean, coaches get mad sometimes, right? We know that. They holler and shout and curse, and it doesn't make them bad guys. But he was always over the line, stomping, screaming, berating officials, berating his own players, berating league officials who were sitting near his bench at the Valley Tournament. And we all kind of rolled our eyes and thought, man, that's a bad look. But nobody really did anything to stop it. The league didn't. Now, we didn't see him physically hurting players, or we didn't hear him saying racist and sexual things to players, in a twisted manner. But apparently that was happening too. Is it hard to believe that was happening? Not if you ever saw him coach during a game. Clearly he was not able to control his emotions. So it makes me wonder what Wichita State knows and what they knew before this investigation and before the reports came out, because I think they're trying to cover their tail. But it also makes me, I think, look at myself a little harder and say, hey, if something is bad, then call it out, because you know these are young players and they have a scholarship hanging over their head. But we also have been saying, look, this test has stopped. So I think the lesson for us is not that we would not have reported on if we knew what really was happening. And I credit the reporters who covered college basketball who found out, but you know, not tolerating some of that stuff when we see it in small doses in front of us, and not saying, oh, that's just Greg Marshall being Greg Marshall. No, it's a coach being a jerk.
In terms of the college basketball season, the schedule for SLU is there, I think. It's kind of there in pencil,
right.
Not in pen. What are you hearing about the schedule right now for SLU?
Well, I think every college basketball schedule is in pencil this season, especially the non-conference games. What we know about SLU is we're starting to see some of those non-conference games. It sounds like their season tip-off will be in Nebraska at this kind of event that's being hosted there, and it's going to be a Thanksgiving afternoon game. They'll play two games in that event, and then they'll start playing more of a normal non-conference schedule. They had a game that they thought they were going to play, kind of drop out on them. It sounds like, you know, they're not really officially confirming everything all at once, in part because there could be some changes, and it's all, of course, kind of hanging on the hope that everything goes smoothly. You've refreshing Twitter every day this week, there's been one of these basketball events that's been canceled or a school that has pulled out, but it does seem like SLU is getting close to saying, okay, tentatively, here's what they're going to try to do. Now, hopefully they're able to stick with that. Meanwhile, the excitement for SLU continues to grow. I mean, you think about, you know, I've seen John Rothstein of CBS say that he thinks they're the best non-Power 5 team in the country. I talked to Dana O'Neill this week, who writes The Athletic, and she thinks they're the best mid-major, could be one of the best mid-major in the country. She thinks Richmond is really good too. She has a lot of good things to say about St. Bonaventure, a team that just had to shut down its team activities due to a positive COVID test. They were supposed to play in that tournament, that event at the Mohegan Sun that Mizzou is going to. You know, that was the school a lot of folks thought SLU would open its A-10 schedule with, and that could be changed now. So again, heavy pencil. But it does sound like SLU will at least start in this Golden Window Classic that's going to be played in Nebraska. So that's where we'll begin this, what I'm sure going to be a crazy season.
Ben, what do you think about saying don't start the season in November, December, January, but play February, March, April, and then have May Madness, which has been thrown out there by some?
I understand it. I think it's a reasonable request. I think the hesitancy there is that, you know, there's no necessarily guarantee it will be better. You know, we're all hopeful. I think I don't know that anyone's rooting against the vaccine. It's crazy times, but I think we're all on the same page there in terms of the sooner that gets here, the better, the more likely it will be to get back to a sense of normalcy after that happens. But what I think they're going to have to do probably is really just set some sort of a game limit. And it'll have to be a low one where you have to hit in order to be eligible for the NCAA tournament, and then try to make the best of it after that. They probably should expand the NCAA tournament this year. I think college football should do the same just in order to get a more representative group in there if they're not going to push it back. But pushing it back, I think the fear there is there's no guarantee that it will be any better then. And then you take college basketball out of its kind of traditional time slot in terms of the calendar, and I think college basketball would worry about what it would lose by not having its regular March Madness, by not having its current kind of home on the sports calendar. I think a lot of these ratings things that we're talking about this year, I think a lot of them are related to leagues and teams not being in their usual format. The NFL, it could play opposite times and people would watch. College basketball is one of those ones that probably needs to think long and hard before it starts really tearing up its schedule.
I want to ask you, too, about baseball. And you had a terrific article today in the Post-Dispatch. I would advise everybody to go look at it. When you think about, you know, these young athletes that are in great shape, and does COVID-19 affect them? And what's the lingering effects for them when they try to bounce back and then play at a high level? One of the guys that maybe it really did affect was Lane Thomas. And John Mozeliak had his kind of State of the Union of the St. Louis Cardinals a few weeks back and didn't want to get into too many guys by name of those that suffered from COVID-19, but did mention one player specifically by name, and it was Lane Thomas, and said it did affect Lane Thomas and his performance. You wrote about that in today's Post-Dispatch. For folks that did not read about it, what did you learn about Lane Thomas and the effects of COVID-19 and how it affected his performance?
Well, first I want to shame the folks who didn't read it and encourage them to find that at STL2.com. I'm kidding. Lane was interesting, and I asked Mo about him during that press conference, that Zoom conference, because watching him, to me, and you and I have talked about this, he just didn't look like himself. You know, he made uncharacteristically weird defensive lapses in the outfield. He didn't hit very well, and not that he's, you know, supposed to be Mike Trout, but we've seen him hit when he's been at the level. We just haven't seen very many chances. So I asked, was Lane one of those guys? And Mo said, yeah, you know, he was. There were moments he felt dizzy. There were times he had a hard time catching his breath. So I just reached out to Lane to see if he could explain more about what he went through. And it was interesting talking to him because he's a young guy. He doesn't want to make any excuses. He felt good enough to try to play. But in doing that, and I think the further he's been removed from the season, he's realized, yeah, I wasn't all the way there. Now, he passed all the tests. He jumped over all the hurdles that the Cardinals and Major League Baseball said a guy who was returning had to. But he talks about moments of dizziness. He talks about this cough that followed him for weeks. You know, he would go to eat and he would start coughing. This how heavy his bat felt. And just, you know, he lost 10 to 11 pounds. And he's not a player who naturally carries weight well. I think all those things just really did affect him. And he's not saying that he wished he wouldn't have played. He's not saying any of that. He's just like, now I feel like he feels like he didn't get the chance to prove what he hoped to prove entering the 2020 season. He actually had two fewer at bats than this season, which I guess now is last season, 2020, than he did in 2019. Remember when he got hit on the wrist and broke his wrist and he was out for that reason. So, as we talk about the Cardinals outfield, and we all know it needs to get better, and the Cardinals have said as much, I don't know that we can talk about what Lane Thomas is or isn't because we haven't seen enough of him. We really haven't. Now, you can argue whether or not we've seen enough of Tyler O'Neill, but we've seen way more of Tyler O'Neill than we've seen of Lane Thomas. He actually got less of a chance this year than he did last year, and most of the chance he got this year, like 95% of it, was kind of played through this COVID cloud. So as the Cardinals sift through their options, with a lesson they learned this year about not cutting ties with the guy before they really know what he is or isn't, in Randy Arozarena, not comparing Lane to Randy Arozarena, but how could the Cardinals know for sure what Lane Thomas is based off of what they saw in 2020, knowing now what he was playing through?
In terms of that Cardinal outfield, if they're going to make these guys like Justin Williams, Tyler O'Neill, Lane Thomas, Bader, who do you want to see out of that group? If there was somebody you had to pick and say, okay, I'm going to give 500 bats to one of these players, who is it that you want to see?
I think it would be Lane Thomas. I mean, here's the thing. We've seen the other guys. Now, you can argue maybe it hasn't been enough. Or maybe they deserve more time. But you know, to me, and I get the appeal of Tyler O'Neill, the power potential is there. He won a gold glove. But three seasons now with close to 100, well, he's had more than 130 at-bats in three straight seasons, and his OPS has gotten worse considerably every single season. So I think at some point you shift that opportunity elsewhere. Lane Thomas has had, you know, 35 at bats a season for two. And, you know, I'd like to see what he can do more of. You know, if you're gonna give internal guys more chances, give them to some different guys, I think is what I'd like to see. So I would probably put Lane at the top of that list. It doesn't have to be one thing or the other. The Cardinals could afford to add an outfielder and also find ways for Lane Thomas to play more. We don't know quite sure exactly what they're going to do yet, but I can understand them saying we haven't really been able to give Lane Thomas much of an opportunity. They can't say the same about Harrison Bader and Tyler O'Neill.
Where are you at right now? I know fans are curious with Yadier Molina and Adam Wainwright. I'll start with Yadier Molina, and we know that Steve Cohen is now in control of the Mets. He can spend big money. The Yankees have talked about potentially moving on from Gary Sanchez. There hasn't been a lot of movement thus far in Major League Baseball in the free agency period, but what do you think about Yadier Molina and his future?
Well, we know that any time the Yankees are contacting a player in free agency that a team is hoping to keep, that's a little bit of a threat, right? I mean, the Yankees are an appealing team. They've won more championships than the Cardinals, the only team that has won more championships than the Cardinals. And I think that anytime they're in the conversation, your antenna goes up a little bit. I'm curious about the catcher market and how it could be tilted by New York, because if Cohen wants to go out and spin big, maybe he becomes a player for Real Muto, which would make maybe the Yankees need to counter that move. And if you don't have to get too far down the list of most appealing free agent catchers after Real Muto, I would probably put Yadier Molina at least tied for second because of what he means and the legacy that he brings. I think that would be appreciated by Yankees fans. So I think that does worry me a little bit. Now, we haven't heard of any other teams being willing to make Molina a 2-year offer. If they are, that hasn't been out yet. I do think the Cardinals would probably be willing to do that. But if it's going to come down to 1-year deals and both New York teams are looking at catchers, then I think the Cardinals could find this to be a little more of a conversation than they were maybe expecting to have at least entering the year. It's bad timing for the Yankees to be considering moving on from Gary Sanchez. If the Yankees decide to give Gary Sanchez another shot, then it would probably help the Cardinals out quite a bit. As for Adam Wainwright, you had the news since we've last talked of the Braves picking up Drew Smyly on a 1-year, $11 million deal. That was the team that had apparently been in some conversations with Adam's camp. I think maybe that could, hurt the chances of Wainwright departing to Atlanta, in part because I think if Wainwright's going to leave, I would think he's going to want a sure thing shot to start, which is what he will have here based off of what he did last season. If he's willing to take another 1-year deal like he did the previous 2 years with the Cardinals, I would imagine that's all he's going to get offered elsewhere in this climate. And it sounds like the Braves at least now could have a starting rotation complete, and Wainwright would be maybe more in that what-if swingman type role or competing for a spot in the rotation. He knows if he's back here, he's going to get every opportunity to start, and I wonder how they would factor in that thinking.
All right, who do you have in Mizzou, South Carolina, tomorrow? I'll wrap it up with this. Who do you got?
I'm going to pick Mizzou, Dan. I think they're going to finish the season really strong here. There's really two types of teams left in college football, one that has something to play for and one that doesn't. And Missouri is going to be a team that has something to play for, you know, continuing its momentum under Eli Drinkwitz. And it's going to be playing a lot of teams on the other side of that divide here. South Carolina with a fired head coach, Georgia without a chance to win the SEC championship, Vanderbilt, the worst team in the SEC, maybe one of the worst in college football. Really the only team that's on the right side of things that Mizzou's going to play down the stretch is Arkansas. It will be the battle of the two first-year SEC coaches who have performed the best. So I like Mizzou to win against South Carolina on Saturday.
All right, buddy. Thank you. We'll catch you up next Friday. Appreciate it.
Sounds good, man. Talk soon. Have a good weekend.
You too.